Chapter 23. In any homicide investigation, the starting point must be to consider who had motive to end the life of the deceased. Reasons for doing so normally include hatred, anger, possible humiliation or embarrassment, jealousy, monetary gain, and revenge with threat of exposure for wrongdoing, resulting in punishment, also added to the mix. Most often coupled together are anger and money. The follow-the-money trail, so often welcomed in any investigation, may be beneficial regarding one suspect in Dorothy Kilgallen's murder. Anger and even hatred can also play a part with another suspect, who had jealousy on his mind as well. Possible humiliation and embarrassment can be a motive with another of the suspects, and threat of exposure for wrongdoing definitely must be considered with at least three of the possible suspects, especially one of them. Any fresh investigation of a cold case like Kilgallen's, 50-plus years old, focusing on motive also requires considering the homicide detective's remaining best friends, means, opportunity, and benefit from the crime. A prosecutor assigned to her case would be charged with filling in the blanks so that a jury could convict the accused beyond a reasonable doubt. Based on those who had reason to cheer if Kilgallen were silenced, the suspects must include Richard Colmar, as well as Frank Sinatra and other celebrities criticized through the years in Kilgallen's Journal American columns and articles, and perhaps even those disagreeing with her opinions on the Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick radio program. In view of Kilgallen's obsession with the JFK and Oswald assassinations, and her columns squarely pointing in the opposite direction of the Oswald alone theory, the CIA, the State Department, the Russians, Cuban dissidents, and President Lyndon Johnson seem logical suspects. Add to this list two individuals with much to gain from Kilgallen's death, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover and New Orleans Mafia Don Carlos Marcello. If those who plied their trade in the entertainment industry had been interviewed when Kilgallen died, the results, in all likelihood, would have been mixed. Certainly she had her supporters, but along the way to her reaching the summit of being the most successful and best-known newspaper columnist of her era, the hard-charging Kilgallen made enemies. During the 2017 interview with New York Post reporter Susan Edelman, Kilgallen's daughter Jill, who was 22 years old and married when her mother died, stated the obvious when she said, "Mom could alienate people." The feisty reporter's daily words could be career-ending. Some were insulted with a scathing review or being slighted with no mention in the column. Certainly those producing the 1961 Broadway show Sail Away, a musical with lyrics by Noel Coward, had been upset with the scathing review she provided. Ticket sales had bottomed out, and Coward later wrote, "The gloominess of the present situation can be accounted for, up to a point, by the tone of the notices. They weren't all bad by any means, but there was much emphasis on its being old-fashioned and thin. Then Dorothy Kilgallen slammed it on the radio. She has recently done the same for Puccini and Leontine Price." Others may have been upset with Kilgallen's disclosures about their private life. Still others objected to an inside story of a business transaction they believed crossed the bounds of professionalism. Any one of them could have killed her, or had her killed. When Kilgallen died, any possible threats could have been investigated. This did not happen, not by the police or the DA's office. Mark Sinclair said Christina Ford, the second wife of Henry Ford II, chief executive officer of the Ford Motor Company, was upset with Kilgallen writing about Jackie Kennedy instead of Lady Bird Johnson following Lyndon Johnson's installation as president. Mrs. Henry Ford didn't like the Kennedys. A lot of people did not like the Kennedys and wanted them out of office. You have to understand what I am saying. Sinclair stated, "Christina gave me a toy gun once and told me to give it to Dorothy to dry her eyelashes with. And it was a very vulgar gun, and if it had been real, it could have blown Dorothy's head off. I threw it in the trash can. I wouldn't have taken it to Dorothy. Many suspects exist with strong dislike for Kilgallen, both on a personal as well as professional level. For instance, at one point, she and late-night talk show host Johnny Carson began a tug-of-war with hurtful words on both sides. Kilgallen accused him in one of her columns of needlessly telling off-color jokes during the days when LBJ was inaugurated. During a White House photographer's dinner, he blasted Kilgallen, stating, "That's like having your clothes criticized by Emmett Kelly, famous circus clown. I don't know why Dorothy should take offense at a joke I made. I didn't when her parents made one." In the 1967 radio interview with Long John Neville, Richard Colmar stated, "I know there was a little thing between her and Johnny Carson, which, thank God, blew over very quickly. Johnny, I believe, was doing a benefit in Washington, and she was down there. I think it was at the time of the inauguration." Dorothy felt that some of his remarks were not in good taste, and wrote about it. Chief among those who hated Kilgallen with venom in his heart was singer Frank Sinatra. It was a well-publicized public war. Kilgallen pounded his reputation on a daily basis for months at a time. He struck back. Kilgallen and Sinatra's relationship had not always been combative. In fact, early on in his career, she wrote of his prowess as a top entertainer. After a New Year's appearance at the Copacabana nightclub and restaurant in New York City, Kilgallen wrote, "The list of celebrities who can't get to see Sinatra is almost more glittering than the roster of those who make it." Latest victims of the velvet rope included Zsa Zsa Gabor, international playboy Porfirio Rubirosa, and Marlon Brando. Kilgallen then wrote what Sinatra concluded was a biting column about him just before the 1960 election, connecting JFK with Sinatra. Only a few months ago, Senator Jack Kennedy had the crying towel out because those columnists were linking him with Frank Sinatra, and the senator protested the association was unfair because he had only met him a few times in California. So last week, the Democratic candidate for the presidency was the guest of honor at a private little dinner given by Frank. No reason why he shouldn't, of course, but why try to kid the press? Since Sinatra was so popular with the general public, most columnists were careful not to condemn the singer for his devilish behavior. But any goodwill between the two celebrities disappeared when Kilgallen not only blasted Sinatra's career and his private life, but also his close friendship with members of the mafia. To be sure, Kilgallen was not the first to do so, since Sinatra was attacked in various columns for underworld connections. This included his appearances at the mob-controlled Sands Hotel in Las Vegas. There, according to his FBI file, secured by this author under the Freedom of Information Act, Sinatra pimped for John Kennedy. The notation read, "It was a known fact that the Sands Hotel was owned by hoodlums, and that while the senator, Kennedy, Sinatra, Peter Lawford were there, showgirls from all over town were running in and out of the Sands." However, Kilgallen's manner of criticizing Sinatra somehow triggered a hatred for her that was unmatched concerning other critics. He was especially furious to the point of extreme fits of anger when Kilgallen printed his New York City address. When he moved, she printed it again. Sinatra, in turn, had a fake tombstone with Kilgallen's name embossed on it delivered to her office. Whether it was sent in jest or pretended of evil intent was unknown. In February 1956, Kilgallen, as noted, had infuriated the My Way singer by penning the real Frank Sinatra story, making light of his girlfriends and alluding to his mafia connections. In another seething column answering a reader complaint about JFK being friendly with Sinatra, she chastised the singer for being a successful tough guy who refers to women as broads and gets off airplanes with a drink in his hand. In the true Sinatra fashion, no rules and plenty of booze and girls anywhere you look. During a Copacabana appearance in New York City, Sinatra fought back with fury, telling his audience, "Dottie Kilgallen couldn't be here tonight. She's out shopping for a new chin." He then added to laughter and applause, "Come on, let's all chip in and buy Dorothy a new chin," before lifting his glass toward the fans. "This is a toast to my enemies," Sinatra shouted, before spitting the whiskey to the floor. He then added, "That one was for Dorothy Kilgallen." Friends told Sinatra, the son of a Sicilian-born fireman, to stop being so tough on Kilgallen, but he would not listen. At the Sands Hotel, he held up a car key while asking the cheering audience, "Doesn't this look like Dorothy Kilgallen's profile?" While performing at the Villa Venice outside Chicago with Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr., Sinatra became even more accusatory. "I've met many, many male Finks, but I never met a female Fink until I met Dorothy Kilgallen. How's that for an opener? I wouldn't mind if she was a good-looking Fink. The town where she came from had a beauty contest when she was 17 years old, and nobody won." Sinatra's battles with the working press were legendary. In 1976, Pulitzer Prize-winning Chicago Daily News journalist Mike Royko tangled with the unruly singer when Sinatra was granted protection by the Chicago Police Department. Royko first called Sinatra's own bodyguards an army of flunkies, and then added, with perhaps a reference to Kilgallen, "I'm surprised that Sinatra, who has such a tough reputation, would need somebody standing outside at all hours. He's an absolute terror when it comes to punching elderly drunks or telling off female reporters." A furious Sinatra was quick to respond in a letter to Royko, who had also made fun of Sinatra's hairpiece. "If you are a gambling man, A, you prove without a doubt that I have ever punched an elderly drunk. Anybody. You can pick up $100,000. Or, B, I will allow you to pull my hairpiece. If it moves, I will give you another $10,000. If it does not, I will punch you in the mouth. How about it?" Years earlier, Sinatra had been incensed with comments made by Lee Mortimer, entertainment editor of the Hearst-owned New York Daily Mirror. He had written of the singer that he befriended cheap hoodlums, and that his fans were morons who worship a man who wanted to socialize with gangsters. On April 8, 1947, Sinatra, who had threatened Mortimer several times, encountered him at Ciro's, a nightclub located in Hollywood. The enraged singer grabbed the columnist, a slight man compared to Sinatra's Hulk, calling him an effing homosexual and a degenerate, while punching him behind his left ear. Hitting Mortimer as his bodyguards held the journalist, Sinatra continued screaming at him before finally warning, "I'll kill you the next time I see you. I'll kill you!" Singer Johnny Mathis, "Chances Are, It's Not For Me to Say," and "Wonderful, Wonderful," had his own encounter with Sinatra during an engagement in London. Violence wasn't the byword, but Mathis repeatedly declined an invitation to a wild party in Sinatra's suite at the Mayfair Hotel, where both celebrities were staying, hosted by Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. The party had begun in Hollywood and stretched to London, with call girls as guests. Sinatra exposed his nasty side when he began berating Mathis, a known homosexual of African-American heritage, during nightclub performances. Sinatra laughed and called Mathis the African Queen. In November 1961, Kilgallen was asked by a Time magazine reporter about the rift with Sinatra. Why he had gone to such extremes to badmouth her and attempted to soil her reputation with personal attacks on how she looked, deficiencies such as being the chinless wonder. Kilgallen's answer was simple. "Sinatra's personal attacks are for one reason and one reason only, because I resisted his sexual advances." No specific information was provided, but there is no evidence available that Sinatra ever defended himself against the accusations. When Sinatra's PR executive, Jim Mahoney, told Sinatra of Kilgallen's death, he simply shrugged. After a pause, he said in a low tone, Dorothy Kilgallen's dead. Well, guess I gotta change my whole act. That he never appeared on What's My Line until after Kilgallen died is no surprise. Sinatra's mafia connections in New York City and around the country have been well chronicled. Those he knew on a friendly basis were gangsters Charles Lucky Luciano, Sam Giancana, Frank Costello, Bugsy Siegel, Mickey Cohen, and Tampa crime boss Santo Traficante. In January 1947, Sinatra enjoyed a vacation with the U.S. crime families, including Carlos Marcello, Joe Bonanno, Traficante, Cohen, Luciano, and others. To cement their friendship, Sinatra gifted Luciano a solid gold cigarette case with the inscription, "To my dear pal Charlie, from his friend Frank Sinatra." The Sinatra-Cohen friendship is worth noting, since Cohen was not only Melvin Belli's client, but a close friend as well. FBI reports obtained by this author through the Freedom of Information Act confirmed Sinatra gave Cohen $20,000, $150,000 in today's currency marketplace, following his release from prison. This happened after Carlos Marcello had also given Cohen cash when the gangster made visiting Marcello his first stop after Cohen was paroled. At one point, Sinatra visited Cohen's L.A. home, requesting that the gangster attempt to mend the singer's ongoing feud with actress Ava Gardner. On another occasion, when Sinatra's career was waning, Cohen organized a testimonial for him at the swank Beverly Hills Hotel. "I love Frank," Cohen said. "I have a very great respect for him, and even when he was at his worst, I was his best friend." Like Belli, whom close friend Milton Hunt told this author was an unofficial member of the San Mateo, California mob, Sinatra loved to hang around mobsters. It made him feel as dangerous as the killers, robbers, and racketeers he admired. One of those gangsters was certainly Sam Giancana, who was shot execution-style in 1975 as he prepared a midnight snack of sausages and spinach in the basement of his Chicago-area home. His daughter Antoinette was quoted as saying, "Sam hated reporters, especially Dorothy Kilgallen." In her book, His Way, author Kitty Kelly wrote of the mobster and the crooner. Both Giancana and Sinatra possessed mercurial temperaments, characterized by wild mood swings and frightening unpredictability. Both wore toupees, gambled, owned points in Las Vegas casinos, drove shiny cars, traveled with an entourage, and relished beautiful women. More important, each had something the other wanted. For Frank, it was the power derived from associating with an underworld capo. For Giancana, it was the opportunity to enrich mafia coffers by using the biggest entertainer in Hollywood as a draw. On many occasions, when Sinatra was accused of a crime, victims and witnesses suddenly disappeared or dropped charges when paid to do so. One primary source who witnessed the Sinatra method of dealing with those who offended him was Kennedy family friend Peter Lawford, married to Patricia Kennedy, JFK's sister. When a violent argument between the two men happened after Lawford dined with Sinatra's love interest, Ava Gardner, Lawford said of the crooner, "I was panicked. I mean, I was really scared. Frank's a violent guy, and he's good friends with too many guys who'd rather kill you than say hello." In October 1961, Kilgallen wrote a searing, lengthy column where she acknowledged Sinatra's talents as well as his fame, while still pointing out his many flaws. She wrote, "I have received many letters like this one," and then added, in part, "Dear Miss Kilgallen, I would find my day lost if I missed your column. Therefore, I would like your opinion why the president and his charming wife would entertain a person such as Frank Sinatra at their home, while the president's brother, Robert Kennedy, is supposed to be going to investigate Sinatra's friends, the Fischettis." Marianne Nolan. In the column, Kilgallen replied, "Miss Nolan, you and all the others who wrote to me are an admirable but naive minority. The majority of people in this country admire, openly or secretly, a successful tough guy who refers to women as broads and gets off airplanes with a drink of whiskey in his hand. I suppose a parlor psychiatrist would deduce there are a great many conforming milquetoasts in this land who would give anything to be cut loose from the wife and kids and the mortgage and community mores and live in the Sinatra fashion. No rules and plenty of boozes and a girl anywhere you look. In any case, next to President Kennedy, Frank Sinatra is the biggest man in America today. He is rich, powerful, and adored by millions of fans. He is more famous than any writer, philosopher, clergyman, or poet. If you don't believe me, walk down your own street and ask the first 50 people you meet who is the author of the last Pulitzer Prize novel. Ask them who is Bertrand Russell. Ask them what Robert Frost does for a living. You'll be surprised at the blank looks. But ask them who Frank Sinatra is, and you'll get 50 right answers. So why shouldn't President Kennedy entertain him if he wants to? The election is over. He won it. During the 1967 radio interview with Big John Nebel, Richard Colmar provided a credible account of the Kilgallen-Sinatra relationship never published before now. He said, "I used to go see Tommy Dorsey, and I got to know Frank, and occasionally we'd sit around and swap stories." Frank said, "Gee, I'm really fed up with this. My contract with Tommy's almost over, and next fall I think I'm going to try it on my own. And, you know, I wished him good luck." So we got a program, I believe on CBS, and people began to take notice of his velvety voice. And then he signed a play in a nightclub on East 57th Street, which no longer exists, El Bongo or something. And I'd been telling Dorothy that this boy really sang great, and let's go to the opening. Continuing, Colmar said, "So we go to the opening, and Frank killed him. He was in top form, and Dorothy wrote a great review and called him a swooner, I think. And this preceded the crooner, and ladies were almost swooning during this particular engagement. And we all know what happened after that. Frank was in the ascendancy. He became a big-name singer, sold, had many gold records behind him. And Dorothy would print nice things whenever she heard a new Sinatra record. She loved his voice. But one day, her editor said, 'Sinatra is so big, won't you do a series on him?' Well, sir, she had to do it in depth. And by that time, Frank had really been getting into some scrapes here and there, and had some very strange friends." Summing up, Colmar told Nebel, "So Dorothy, the good reporter that she is, she couldn't make it all a puff piece. That's so dull. So she did part of it was praising his singing, and occasionally she would drop in a little zing about what she could check out. A hassle that he got into. A hassle at Romanoff's in Hollywood, and a parking lot or something, and, well, he never forgave her. He would publicly take her apart right on a nightclub floor. A friend of mine was in Miami. This is years. He couldn't get off this. Frank is appearing at a big hotel in Miami, and this friend of mine went opening night. By golly, halfway through his show, he went into a 5-minute diatribe, right on the floor, about Dorothy. This friend of mine was furious, and he flew back to New York and called me up right away. Told me all about it, and I was pretty mad, too. And so I told Dorothy, and she said, 'Well, now, come on, calm down, calm down. It's no different. If that's the way he wants to be, there's nothing we can do about it. Don't you get yourself in trouble just because you're steamed up.'" Richard, it appears, certainly was right, since within a bit more than 2 years before Kilgallen died, Sinatra badmouthed his famous adversary during a September 1963 performance with his Rat Pack partners Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. at the Sands Hotel. Toward the end, after audience celebrity introductions, Lucille Ball, Tommy Sands, his own wife Nancy Sinatra, and drummer Buddy Rich, Sinatra exclaimed, "As a parting remark, ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to leave you with one thought. If you happen to run into Dorothy Kilgallen, be sure you're in your car. Then the Rat Pack closed the act with Oldest Established Permanent Floating Crap Game from Guys and Dolls. Based on the roller coaster relationship between the famous singer and the famous columnist, certainly one that went downhill after Kilgallen badmouthed Sinatra in the Journal American, if the singer wanted to rid himself of his archenemy Kilgallen, his good friends in the underworld, or the goons he employed as bodyguards, could have handled the task. Motive was a given since he detested her, and he certainly had the means and opportunity to rid the world of the famous reporter. Without doubt, the bitter Sinatra benefited from her death. There was no more Dorothy Kilgallen to badmouth him, his private life, and his mafia connections. Whomever Sinatra, whose mother Dolly had said of him, "Yes, my son is like me. You cross him, he never forgets." Directed to kill his enemy, could hide the crooner's involvement, so there was no link to the singer. That Sinatra, whose music today is appreciated, despite his having been a reprehensible low-life womanizer and thug, was never even questioned by the authorities after Kilgallen died, is another example of incompetence, of the greatly admired reporter being denied the justice she deserved. Bottom line, did Frank Sinatra hate Dorothy Kilgallen enough to kill her or have her killed? If so, he had to get in line, since, though she was seemingly an unlikely threat as a slight woman with absolutely no propensities for violence, her powerful nature made her the target of harm by at least four other people.